Thank you, Mark and Alicia, for all your hard work. Let me just jump right in and show the quantum field theory that I would like to discuss. Later in the talk, I'll get to some outline of the talk. So this theory is just a scalar field theory. It has four derivatives, both in the interaction terms and the kinetic terms. It involves a dimensionless real scalar field and dimensionless couplings, lambda 3 and lambda 4, for the cubic and quartic interactions. It has a shift symmetry, phi to phi plus c, and that forbids many other possible terms that could also have dimensionless couplings. And there's a mass squared term, which is actually a kinetic, two-derivative term, and that breaks the classical scale invariance. So I'm presenting this as a proxy for quadratic gravity. Quadratic gravity has the Einstein action supplemented with terms quadratic in the curvature, and these terms bring in four derivatives. Later in the talk, I'll actually show the action for quadratic gravity. So these four derivatives are both in the kinetic and interaction terms, and basically, because of that, both of these theories are renormalizable. Now, in the scalar theory, the shift symmetry is playing the role of coordinate invariance of the gravity theory. And then there's this mass squared two-derivative term, and that's playing the role of the Einstein term. Now, at low energies, this term dominates. And at low energies, then, we're left with a normal massless field with non-renormalizable interactions, as we're used to with gravity. So both these theories are UV complete, and so we can see what happens at energies much higher than the mass. And I'll refer to this as the m to zero limit. So in the case of gravity, that limit corresponds to ultra-Planckian energies. So the story turns out to be very similar for these two theories, and basically just because it's about the physics of four derivatives. Of course, the scalar theory is much easier to deal with, in particular to do loop diagrams. So I'm just going to focus on that. Near the end of the talk, I will return to quadratic gravity, though. So the main topic is the ghost. The four derivatives means that the propagator has two poles. And the massive pole has this abnormal sign residue. And that means a negative norm state. Now, that's actually a statement about how you quantize the theory. So in this way to quantize the theory, there's no negative energies. All energies are positive. So we don't have to talk about instabilities in this theory. But we have to live with the negative norm. And that's said to be in conflict with unitarity. But I don't think that's a very precise statement. I think what's actually meant by this is that the theory may have problems with positivity. I'm saying this because S matrix unitarity can still be defined in the presence of negative norm states. So you still have the defining relation for S matrix unitarity. You just have to be a little more clear what the identity operator means by the completeness relation that sum over states there you see involves the norm. So that's where minus signs can enter into the definition of the identity operator. In any case, the S matrix unitarity defined by that relation still means that probability is conserved. Now, a more direct thing you can do is just to look at the optical theorem and directly verify it in perturbation theory by keeping track of the minus signs that you know are in the theory. So the left-hand side of the optical theorem is the imaginary part of a forward scattering amplitude, and its calculation is affected by any wrong sign propagators. The right-hand side is a scattering process into on-shell final states, and that's affected by any negative norms among those states. So I think it can be seen, or at least it may not be that surprising then, that the left and right-hand side of the optical theorem are both affected in such a way that it remains satisfied. So the issue is positivity. And if the issue is positivity rather than unitarity, then I think this at least leaves some room open for discussion. There are certainly some abnormal minus signs floating around in calculations, but the question is whether physical quantities that should be positive can end up being positive. And this needs some investigation. So our focus here will be on the positivity constraint in the high energy limit, but we will return to lower energies as well. First thing we can look at are the beta functions, and they can be calculated in a standard way where you treat the wave, the renormalization of this four derivative kinetic term in the standard way as a wave function renormalization. And that leads to this result for the two beta functions as a function of the two couplings. So I'm saying that's a standard result, but as far as I know, that did not appear in the previous literature. Rather than talk about how to calculate the beta functions, we should just look at the renormalization group flow from those beta functions in the space of these two couplings. For lambda 3, I'm only showing positive values because for negative values, you just get the mirror image of what you see here. So if you can see the arrows, they point towards the UV. So for most of this diagram, you see the arrows pointing towards the origin, and that means asymptotic freedom in the UV. Over on the left, though, you see some of these lines looping around and approaching the origin in the IR. So for those lines or flows, you have both asymptotic freedom both in the IR and the UV. Okay, so if we're talking about the flow towards the IR, that'll stop when the energy you're talking about drops below this, the mass M. Because that just is the transition scale to the low energy theory that I've already mentioned. So the low energy theory is a completely different theory. So this crossover to this low energy theory may occur at weak coupling, in which case the theory remains perturbative at all scales. But if M is sufficiently small, then the flow towards the IR can continue, and you can result in large couplings. That, in turn, can create a new mass scale through dimensional transmutation. Now, quadratic gravity also has an asymptotically free coupling, so this dimensional transmutation may be the actual origin of the Planck scale, or Planck mass in gravity. Okay, here's what I want to talk about for the rest of the talk. I want to describe a simplified method for calculating in the high energy limit. So the old method involves decomposing phi into 2 degrees of freedom. In this new method, there just appears to be, I stress the word appears, to be only 1 degree of freedom at high energies. So I'm going to use this to calculate the optical theorem and differential in a full differential cross-section as functions of both couplings. In my previous work, I set lambda 3 to 0. But now we have these expressions that we can test for positivity. And the punchline is that positivity picks out the allowed region in the RG flow diagram. Now, there's a related issue. We have four derivatives, and those interaction terms then apparently produce diverging amplitudes at large momentum. Amplitudes go like P to the fourth. Now, in my earlier work, I found there are non-standard cancellations that take place at the cross-section level, and I saw that first in quadratic gravity itself. But what I'm talking about here is this reduction to what seems like 1 degree of freedom at high energies, and at least this clarifies what's happening and makes much more clear the origin of the good high energy behavior. So let's introduce a mass derivative. Let's look at the quartic propagator. And notice, as we all know, it can be written in terms of the Feynman propagator as a difference between the massive and massless Feynman propagators divided by m squared with a minus sign. So if you look at what I just said there, that's in the limit of m to 0 is a derivative. So in that limit, the quartic propagator can just be written as a mass squared derivative of the Feynman propagator. So let's take this over to the optical theorem. Looking at the left-hand side, the imaginary part of a forward scattering amplitude is usually, or can be extracted by cutting propagators and using the fact that the imaginary part of a Feynman propagator is the delta function. If we're trying to do the same thing for the quartic propagator then, in that m to 0 limit, we can just apply this mass squared derivative to the delta function. So with this, it's maybe not surprising that this additional operation I'm talking about here, the mass derivative squared in the mass to 0 limit, also works on the right-hand side of the optical theorem. So on the right-hand side of the optical theorem, we have on-shell particles in some final state. So to carry over this mass squared derivative, we should assign each of those particles in the final state its own dummy mass. And so the amplitude squared then, if we calculate it, will depend on the values of these MJs via the on-shell conditions for the final state particles. And then we can just take these mass derivatives, take the mass to zero limit. We're left with something that we can take the phase space integral, which is needed in the optical theorem. And so just to be very explicit there, that's what this thing looks like. I'm making very clear the dependence on the masses. But I've left implicit what we're actually after. We're actually after the dependence on something like the center of mass energy squared, the S variable. Now, let's apply this to this process phi phi to phi phi. So the amplitude that we need to square involves these three level diagrams, the first one coming from the lambda 4 interaction, the other three from lambda 3 interaction. And I'm saying this new method reproduces what you would normally do. You sum over the phi phi final states. So in that sum, for each phi, you choose one mass and then the other mass. You insert a minus sign for the negative norm. The negative norm enters the definition of a cross section. And divide by m squared due to the way the field's normalized in this theory. So I think you can see that doing all that is the same as taking those mass squared derivatives in the limit of m going to zero. Now let's go to the left-hand side of the optical theorem. So there are various loop diagrams we have to calculate. The first one on the left is lambda 4 squared. The next two are lambda 4, lambda 3 squared. And the last three are lambda 3 to the fourth. So to calculate those diagrams, we can again use this mass squared derivative business and mass to zero limit. But this limit is smooth, since the imaginary part has no infrared divergences. And to make things even more simple, we can just directly use the massless limit of the quartic propagator. So that's the square of a Feynman propagator. It can be handled by standard methods for calculating one-loop diagrams. So I think that's about as simple as it can get. But this theory still have these four derivative vertices, which still complicate things. So with all that, we can now calculate both sides of the optical theorem. And from what I said before, it's not surprising that these two independent calculations give the same result. In any case, this equality demonstrates S-matrix unitarity. And the other thing you've seen is I've calculated both sides without decomposing phi into positive and negative norm parts. The other thing, I've mentioned p to the fourth as in the amplitude. If you square it, then you might have expected s to the fourth to show up. But with this method I just described, I think you now see why s to the fourth does not show up, because we're taking two mass square derivatives. So two factors of s had to be mass squares. Okay, just the other thing, though, the important thing is positivity. At the level of an amplitude squared, of course, that's positive definite, but after taking two mass squared derivatives, then it's not guaranteed to be positive definite anymore. So it's not for a certain range of lambda 4 over lambda 3 squared. And if we put that range onto our flow diagram, it's the orange shaded region, and on top of that region is a red line, lambda 4 equals minus a half lambda 3 squared. Now, I think you can see that that red line has meaning even before we did the calculation. The red line marks the boundary between those two sets of flows which are different. The ones below the flow are asymptotically free in both the UV and the IR. So eventually in the UV, though, all those lines will eventually hit and enter the orange region. So all such flows are forbidden by positivity. So by positivity, the allowed flows are either on or to the right of the red line. And so what the theory is picking out are these couplings which are asymptotically free in the UV and can become strong in the IR. Now, I've been talking about, is there 1 degree of freedom or 2 degrees of freedom? Let's consider the two fields constructed from phi in this way, psi 1 and psi 2. In that construction, if you express the original kinetic term of the original Lagrangian in terms of psi 1 and psi 2, you get a sum of two normal quadratic terms for the kinetic terms. So that shows that psi 1 and psi 2 are the two fields of definite mass, 0 and m, and definite norm, 0 and minus. But on the other hand, if you go back to the definition and take the difference of psi 1 minus psi 2, the boxes cancel out, the m squares cancel out, and you're left with phi. So phi is just the difference. But everything in the original theory was expressed in terms of phi. All the interactions are expressed in terms of phi. So basically, psi 1 minus psi 2 is the only combination that appears in all the interaction terms. Now, at the same time, we've introduced this operation of the mass squared derivative for every external phi line. And that also treats psi 1 and psi 2 on equal footing with a relative minus sign. So in that sense, the external state matches the interacting state. And so that's why I'm saying that it looks like there are just a 1 degree of freedom instead of 2. So now let's turn to a full differential cross-section for the same process, phi phi to phi phi. I calculate it as if I have a normal scalar field. Well, not quite, because there is a propagator in some of those diagrams. But I just calculate it, and then I have to take four mass derivatives, one for each external line. So I need the dependence on four of those masses. And then at that stage, before taking the mass derivatives, I would end up with something that goes like s to the fourth over s, where the 1 over s comes from the definition of the cross-section. But we have to take the mass derivatives, so that's not going to work. We need a term where there are four factors of the mass squared. So that'll survive. And now we can see why we have a 1 over s behavior for our cross-section. In my previous work, I had to sum up many different exclusive differential cross-sections, and I was finding what looked like amazing cancellations. But now it's not so hard to understand why this is occurring. For the actual result, here it is. It is kind of a complicated function of the scattering angle. There's a 1 over sine to the fourth downstairs coming from those exchange diagrams, which come from the lambda 3 interaction. But the question is, when is this thing positive? Well, it's positive definite for any theta as long as lambda 4 is greater than or equal to minus a half lambda 3 squared. So that's the same constraint we already have talked about. One special case is if you're sitting right on the red line, that's also positive, and all that angle dependence goes away. So anyway, in this result, you get this constraint, which just eliminates that whole orange region in one shot. And what saying that once again, positivity has picked out the running couplings that flow to strong coupling in the infrared. So that leads into a QCD analogy. We've been able to work in the asymptotically free regime where perturbative degrees of freedom are appropriate. And so that's similar to doing perturbative QCD to study scattering of quarks and gluons at very high energies, even though the quarks and gluons are not the asymptotic states of the theory. These calculations are done all the time for LHC to make all kinds of physical predictions, even though you're working with non-asymptotic states. Now, they're not asymptotic states because strong interactions at intermediate energies are there. So by intermediate energies, I mean not the high energy regime and not the low energy regime where the low energy theory applies. So in between are the strong interactions. Okay, so for the four derivative theory, that leads to the question, what are the asymptotic states? Well, the point of strong interactions is the poles of bare propagators need not correspond to the true asymptotic states of the theory. You might say, well, maybe the ghost becomes some kind of bound state, and maybe that still is an asymptotic state. Well, another example from QCD is the sigma meson, and that has a width of order its mass around 0.5 GeV. So in no way is that an asymptotic state. The sigma meson is also interesting because it's basically the lightest state in the theory besides the pseudo-Goldstone bosons, which sit in the low energy theory. And clearly, the large width is coming from the fact that the sigma meson decays into those pseudo-Goldstone bosons. In the case of gravity, we have a ghost sitting there, and it can decay into the gravitons. So the situation is very similar. So for both the scalar theory and the gravity theory, we do seem to need to suppose that the ghost is not an asymptotic state. And once you suppose that, then as long as all asymptotic states have positive norm, then all probabilities, all cross-sections are positive. Now, that doesn't mean that the ghost is invisible. It can show up as bumps in various energy distributions. So any virtual effect of the ghost is okay. Now let me say a few things about the shift symmetry. So if one of those fields, the psi one, the massless one, transforms under the shift symmetry in the same way as phi does. Psi two, on the other hand, doesn't transform. Now we can suppose that the shift symmetry is not broken by the strong interactions, and then psi one, well, this then allows psi one to survive as a true asymptotic state. So we end up with 1 degree of freedom at whatever energy is needed is used to probe the theory. So that's either the psi one, which is the true asymptotic state, or it's the psi one minus psi two in this perturbative high energy description that I'm talking about, where you have to use the perturbative states, not the asymptotic states. Now I can finally get to quadratic gravity, and there's the action. I should mention a few references here. John Donahue has played a major role in reviving this theory. And of course, Kelly Stella is the inventor of this theory. The way I've written it here, you can see that it introduces a massive spin 2 ghost and a massive scalar. We're interested more in the ghost than the scalar, and the Newton's constant times the mass of the ghost squared is a dimensionless and asymptotically free coupling. So that's one similarity to the scalar theory. And the spin 2 sector has the graviton and the ghost, and that's completely analogous to psi 1 and psi 2. So everything I've been saying about psi 1 and psi 2 would apply to the graviton and the ghost, or in principle could apply. We're talking about two different theories. Okay, our comments, things apply except for the fact that we're talking about shift symmetry instead of coordinate invariance. So just to summarize a little bit again about the ghost, so in the high energy limit, the ghost is entering on an equal footing as a perturbative degree of freedom, and it plays an intrinsic role in achieving positivity and these well-behaved cross-sections. It's essential for the good high-energy behavior. This high-energy picture, though, is independent of whether or not the ghost is an asymptotic state. It doesn't enter this perturbative description. But it does seem that if you want to consider the full theory, then this asymptotic state, the ghost not being an asymptotic state seems to be required. So quadratic gravity, I think, gives a change of perspective. On the very small, we have a standard quantum field theory of ultra Planckian energies. And on the very large, we have arbitrarily large horizonless classical solutions called tutu holes. Now, I have a few minutes, or maybe 1 minute, I can show one more slide. What is a tutu hole? Well, it's a gravitationally bound ball of relativistic gas described by a solution that appears in quadratic gravity, but not Einstein gravity. The compactness of this thing is essentially the same as a black hole, even though it has no horizon. And if you want to ask some question like, what is the total entropy? Well, you look at the gas inside this thing. It has an entropy density. You integrate over that. You get something you could call the entropy S22. There's also a temperature at infinity. The product of those two things is the same as the same product for the black hole, just M over 2. But those individual quantities are not the same. S22 over black hole is given by something like that. N is the number of particle species in nature. And S22 depends on that. So I would say that's a feature, not a bug. In the case of the black hole, it does not depend on the number of species of nature. And that leads into something called a species problem for the black hole. And I would call that a bug. Okay, so I think I'll stop there.
Yeah. Time for a couple of questions.
How could you truncate to R squared? Why don't you generate higher derivatives? Why is it a reasonable thing to do from EFT?
I'm talking about the quantum theory where I'm just using the standard idea of renormalizability. So those terms are not generated in the quantum theory. Just like in QCD, you're not generating high powers of the curve of the F mu of the gauge theory.
Sorry, why am I not generating? I am generating them, but they are irrelevant in the IR.
In the fundamental theory, it's defined just by the terms you see.
Even if it's not renormalizable, it's different from QCD. QCD, strongly coupled in the IR. Is it strongly coupled, though, in the IR?
Just like QCD, it gets strongly coupled in the IR.
I see. So a priori, it could
be. So then you're generating all kinds of stuff in the IR.
So a priori, it's not related to gravity.
What?
A priori, it's probably not related to gravity. It's something strongly coupled.
I'm saying quadratic gravity. I'm proposing quadratic gravity as the theory of quantum gravity.
But then, at large distances, does it become usual gravity, or does it become something else?
Well, I spoke about the low energy theory. The low energy theory, the Einstein term dominates, and you go over to a standard picture of a massless graviton described by Einstein gravity plus non-renormalizable terms. Now, those are the things you're talking about. They're all there, seen in the low energy theory. Okay, so that's different from the UV theory.
Okay, there are some online questions.
Okay, question from the chat from Sergei Zibaryakov. He's asking, in the scalar theory, let us keep M finite so that the theory is weakly coupled at all scales. Will the Gauss be an asymptotic state in this case? Will it create problems with positivity?
Yes, he's saying exactly right. If M is not too small, then the theory remains perturbative at all scales. And you would have a perturbative ghost. Now, that ghost could still decay, so some of what I say would apply. But the more you go to this weak limit, the more and more it looks like something quite bad is happening. You can talk about scattering of this almost stable particle, and you would get negative cross-sections. So going to the other limit of strong interactions, I think you enter a completely different type of picture where you can make use of this loophole in quantum field theory, which is the fact that not everything you think you see in the perturbative theory is actually an asymptotic state. Yeah.
Okay. There is one comment by Kelly.
Hi, Bob. Nice talk. Is there a phase structure in this scalar model where the absence of the ghost in the asymptotic states depends upon regimes? Is there a phase where it should be? It should have been in there. So you want to decide that you're not in that phase.
A phase transition?
Yeah.
Would you say the same thing happens in QCD?
You give the example of QCD, right? There is a high energy, there's a decoupling phase, a deconfinement phase, sorry, where the quarks appear. Is there something like that happening here?
Yeah, in QCD it's confinement which removes those things as asymptotic states. And something that John Donahue has emphasized, it's just as something more simple, decay can do it. So, knowing what the full propagator is for the ghost, or what it might look like, is still being debated.
Okay, so I would postpone all the other questions to the discussion session. So let's thank Bob again. There is the coffee break now.